I'm going to begin my sermon this morning with a little bit of a congregation-wide challenge. So I hope you brought your competitive juices with you this morning. We're going to play a little game that you will know as a staring contest, okay? So staring contests are super easy. There's really only two rules. One, when I say go, you need to pick someone generally in your area, lock eyes. You need to open your eyes as wide as you can. And the second rule is don't blink, okay? Don't blink. Don't look away. If there isn't someone that you know that you feel comfortable staring at for a short period of time, pick a spot somewhere in the sanctuary, lock your eyes, open wide, and stare. Does everyone understand the instructions? Okay, one, two, three, go. And as you keep staring here, I'm going to talk to you. Do you ever wonder who decided that staring should be made into a contest? It's a little bit weird, right? We all know that it's not. Some of you have lost already. This is unbelievable. If your eyes are still open, it's usually about 10 seconds into the contest that we begin to feel this slight burning in our eyes. That tells us there's something wrong. At 25 seconds, the pain becomes less manageable, and we begin to say to ourselves, why am I doing this? This is the dumbest thing ever. Now, if your eyes are still open, I want you to close them. Everyone close your eyes just for a moment. When we close our eyes after a staring contest, the pain very quickly begins to recede. Keep your eyes closed. The memory of our stupidity and what we bore vanishes away. I want you to open your eyes for a moment. Now, I gave a few of the option of picking a point in the sanctuary, just keeping your eyes open and staring at it. And the reason I did that is because a true staring contest always involves two people, and it's a little bit strange and more than a little unnerving to lock eyes with someone. Close proximity and intense gaze makes for a tremendous awkwardness. And even if we're staring at someone that we know and love, there's a part of each one of us that just wants to look away as quickly as possible. And sadly, this desire to look away isn't limited to staring contests. In the presence of pain, injustice, or abuse, the desire to just look away is almost overwhelming. When we don't know what to say or do, when we're frightened, when we feel powerless, we tend to look away. We say to ourselves, well, someone else will say something or do something, someone more qualified or influential than me. But this failure to act, to say or do something, anything, can be just as destructive as saying or doing the wrong things ourselves. At times, the failure to act makes us complicit in the wrongs that are being done against the people around us. On the screen behind me, I have a number of pictures. Each of the women in these pictures represent the most important women in my life. These are all family members of mine, a grandmother, a mother, a mother-in-law, my wife, a sister-in-law, cousins, a daughter, a niece. Canadian stats reveal that 70% of people who experience family violence are women and girls. And according to Government of Canada stats taken from 2008, women are 10 times more likely than men to be victims of sexual abuse. Sexual assault is the only violent crime in Canada today that is not on the decline. According to a national survey conducted in the United States, 81% of women say that they've experienced some form of sexual harassment or sexual assault. 81%. It's a shocking number. And what that means is, of all the women portrayed behind me on the screen, my family members, 7 of these 9 family members in their life have or will experience sexual harassment or sexual abuse of some kind. The title of my message this morning is Don't Look Away. And it's connected to a text that we're going to look at this morning in 2 Samuel, beginning in chapter 13. In this story, we hear the tragic tale of Tamar being sexually abused by her half-brother. We hear the story of her father, David, looking away, saying nothing, doing nothing, resulting in Tamar's brother, Absalom, going after revenge. Now, it's Mother's Day, and this would be the one day of the year that we would prefer to talk about sentimental things, about good things, positive things. I mapped out this preaching series last June, and this text fell on this date. I wrestled this week. Do I say something on this day? And I decided that it's because of the important women in my life and the important women in your life that we can't look away. And we can't ignore the destructive power of sexual harassment or sexual abuse because it affects all of us. So just a moment, I'm going to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 13, and I'm going to begin to read. But before I do, I just want to mention that I have been deeply indebted to Pastor Marty for her thinking and writing and speaking on these kinds of subjects. And much of what I'm going to say today is a direct result of a sermon that Pastor Marty recently preached at a Christian leadership conference at Regent College. And so if you do have a Bible with you, I want to invite you to turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 13. And if you're going to use the blue Bible in the seat rack in front of you, you can find our text on page 249. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. Amnon became so obsessed with his sister Tamar that he made himself ill. She was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. Now, let me just stop there and give you a very brief description of some of David's family tree. So David's firstborn son is Amnon. He was born of Ahinoam, David's second wife. Absalom was David's thirdborn son, born of Maacah, David's third wife. Tamar and Absalom have the same mother, and both claim David as their father. Now, as the firstborn, Amnon was heir to the heir apparent to the throne. Once David died, he was the next in line to become king. But if anything happened to Amnon, Absalom was next in line. I want you to notice the language around Amnon's feelings towards Tamar. He's obsessed to the point of illness. He's unable to do anything to her. Not unable to do anything with her or for her, but unable to do anything to her. What's being described here is not love. It's objectification, it's lust, it's possessive, it's destructive. Now one day, Amnon's cousin, Jonadab, notices that Amnon's looking a little under the weather, and so he asks, "What's up, cuz?" And Amnon says, "I'm feeling ill because of my great love for my half-sister, Tamar." And so the two of them came up with a plan to allow Amnon and Tamar to have some alone time together. Amnon pretended to be ill and then sent word to his father David, "Would you mind, father, sending my sister Tamar with some comfort food so that I will feel better?" Tamar dutifully responds to David's request. She cooks a meal for Amnon, brings it to him, but he pretends he's too ill to eat it. He then banishes everyone from his presence, servants, attendants, and the like, until it's just the two of them. Now reading from verse 10. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food here into my bedroom so that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the bread she'd prepared and brought it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. But when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her and said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." "No, my brother," she said to him, "don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please speak to the king. He will not keep me from being married to you. But he refused to listen to her. And since he was stronger than her, he raped her. Now quoting Marty. Tamar said no. She reasoned with her half-brother. This is wrong. This will disgrace me. You will be reviled. She even suggested that her father David would approve of a marriage between the two of them if he would but ask. Now, Tamar knew better. Such a union was considered incest by biblical law. David wouldn't approve the marriage, but Tamar is desperate. She's buying time. She's trying to get away. Amnon refuses to listen, and he rapes her. Now, verse 15, the story continues. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he loved her. Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." "No," she said to him, "sending me away would be a greater wrong than you've already done to me." But he refused to listen to her. He called his personal servant and said, "Get this woman out of my sight," and bolt the door after her. Again, quoting Marty, four times this text describes Amnon's new feelings towards Tamar. Love has been replaced by hate. The hatred with which he hates her is greater than the love with which he loved her. Amnon is judged by his own words. "Put this woman out of my presence and bolt the door after her." This is a graphic description of the damage done to both offender and offended. Amnon's heart has become twisted. His relationship with his sister is destroyed. The sin of the oppressor and the shame of the oppressed. Before the rape, he calls her my sister. After the rape, he calls her this woman. Verse 18, Tamar was wearing an ornate robe, for this was the kind of garment that the virgin daughters of the king wore. Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the ornate robe she was wearing. She put her hands on her head and went away, weeping aloud as she went. Once again, quoting Marty, this is lament. The tearing of clothes, the wearing of ashes, and sobbing that draws attention to the shame, the violation, the destruction that Amnon has perpetrated. Don't look away. See what has been done to me. This is a prophetic act, crying aloud in times of injustice. Everyone must see and hear. Even though Amnon will not listen, Tamar will be heard. Look at what has been done to me. See my tears and join with me in my cries. But all too often, we look away because we're uncomfortable. We don't know what to say or do, and so we tend to say and do nothing. We look away. We pretend it didn't happen. We hope it, the perpetrator, the crime, the consequences, will simply go away. We sweep things under the carpet, hoping that things will get better. But they never do. It doesn't work that way. Verse 20. Her brother Absalom said to her, Tamar, "Has that Amnon, your brother, been with you? Be quiet for now, my sister. He is your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." And Tamar lived in her brother Absalom's house, a desolate woman. Absalom means well, but he can't fix Tamar's pain. No matter what he says or does, this event has happened. The terrible reality remains. And this story, this ancient story, speaks with such power because it could have been written yesterday. The more things change in the world, the more they stay the same. Marty writes, "Millions of women continue to lament and to live lives that are desolate because of the abuse of masculine power." No doubt all of you are well aware of this global phenomenon, this global social media phenomenon known as Me Too. In an article for Fast Company, Joe Berkowitz writes, "There's nothing new about powerful men being accused of sexual harassment. The unfamiliar part is that there are starting to be actual consequences. These men are losing their jobs, being banned from future opportunities, and in some cases, legal action will almost certainly be forthcoming. As the list of people grows, it includes senators and businessmen, actors and writers, professors and pastors. All of these and many more have been implicated. Don't look away. Verse 21. When King David heard all of this, he was furious, and Absalom never said a word to Amnon, either good or bad. He hated Amnon because he had disgraced his sister Tamar. Now, to this point in the series, and through 1 and 2 Samuel, we've been looking at the many different portraits of David. We've looked at him as a son and as a shepherd, as a warrior, as a fugitive. We've looked at him as a worshiper, as an adulterer, as a king, and now we come to David being portrayed as a father. So David hears this news of sexual abuse perpetrated within his own family, between his own children. David is furious, but in spite of his fury, David did and said exactly nothing. The injustice done to his daughter elicited an emotional response from David, but no action. He was angry, and he looked the other way. And we're left to wonder, why didn't he say or do something? The text doesn't tell us. As I've been contemplating this for weeks and weeks, I've come to the conclusion that at times our woundedness has a way of getting in the way. We know David's story. Previously, David had abused Bathsheba. He forced himself on a married woman. And when it became clear that this married woman was now pregnant with his child, he committed to a series of actions that ultimately led him to have her husband murdered. And I suspect that when David heard this word concerning his son's sexual abuse, he looked away because of his own shame. David wasn't any better than his son. He didn't have any moral ground to stand on. And so in doing nothing, David became complicit in Amnon's abuse. We all know that there is a destructive power that is at work in silence. In the absence of words spoken or action taken, things typically get worse, not better. 2 Samuel 13, verse 23 tells us that while David looked the other way, Tamar's brother Absalom bided his time, plotted against Amnon, and 2 years later had Amnon killed. Now, after the murder of Amnon, Absalom himself fled into self-imposed exile for the next 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, David invited Absalom back to Israel. Absalom was pardoned, but he refused to look his son in the eyes for the next 2 years. Again, silence, inaction. And it fueled the enmity that existed between Absalom and David. Absalom hadn't forgotten what Amnon did to his sister. And he hadn't forgotten what his father said and did, which, remember again, was exactly nothing. Chapters 15 through 19 chronicle the further disintegration within the family. After David pardoned Absalom but then refused to see him, Absalom began to plot revenge against his dad, currying favor everywhere he went. He ultimately was involved in a coup. He seized the throne and tried to have his father killed. David and the rest of the royal family fled and were safe. But in the end, Absalom ended up being killed and the kingdom was restored to David. And the thing that goes over and over in my mind is the thought that as heartbreaking as this tale is, no matter how horrible it is, it was so preventable. The failure to act, to say or do something, can be just as destructive as doing the wrong thing. In the face of abuse, all of us, men and women, can say and do something. In a short while, we're going to gather around the Lord's table, and we're going to remember and celebrate the victory that Jesus won for us at the cross. It was a victory won against evil, against sin, and death. And while we're right to focus on the cross and what Jesus accomplished there, perhaps we don't look hard enough at the life and ministry of Jesus and at all of the many ways that Jesus worked against, in word and deed, the abuse that he saw going on with the powers that were. Much of Jesus' teaching and healing took place among the poor and oppressed. He regularly spoke out against those who misused their power, seeking their own advantage. Jesus made it clear from his perspective that God's use of power, that the right use of power, is always for the sake of serving and protecting others. In Mark 10:45, Jesus said, "For even the Son of Man," which was a title he applied to himself, "for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life away as a ransom for many." That's what power's for. Perhaps you remember the story of Jesus walking into the temple, and there's moneylenders and vendors, and they're ripping off all of the worshipers, standing between their worship of the one true God. And we're told that what Jesus did is he grabbed the rope, he made a whip out of it, and he began to drive the abusers out of the temple, turning over their tables, spilling money everywhere. Jesus got angry, and he acted. At another time, Jesus was at the temple again, teaching, when the religious leaders interrupted him with a woman and they thrust the woman in front of him. She had just been caught in the act of adultery. They publicly shamed her and put Jesus on the spot. "What must we do, Jesus, with this woman? How should she be punished?" And there's a really important question that needs to be asked and answered. If this woman had been caught in adultery, and as they say, it takes two, then where was the man? Why was there only a woman in front of Jesus? Why was the blame being laid entirely at her feet? This is how the abuse of power works. There's always a double standard, winners and losers. But Jesus, this time in a very gentle way, stood with the woman, and he asked the accusers to look within their own hearts. In essence, he said, "Are all of you so pure that you can condemn? Have none of you ever sinned?" And one by one, the accusers began to walk away until only the woman and Jesus were left. Jesus turned to her and said, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" To which she replied, "No one, sir." "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Again, quoting Pastor Marty, Jesus demonstrated that the ways power can be used, that power can be used to heal and bless. Through his life, Jesus showed us the value of women. He healed women, taught women, worked with women, and sent women out to tell others about him. Jesus was a man who throughout his life treated women with respect and dignity. Dorothy Sayers, who's a brilliant author, wrote an essay entitled, "Are Women Human?" And this is what she writes. "Perhaps it's no wonder that the women were first at the cradle and last at the cross. They had never known a man like this man. There had never been such another, a prophet and teacher who never nagged at them, never flattered or coaxed or patronized, who never made jokes about them, never treated them as the women, God help us, or the ladies, God bless them, who rebuked without pettiness and praised without condescension, who took their questions and arguments seriously, who never mapped out their sphere for them, never urged them to be feminine or jeered at them for being female, who had no axe to grind and no uneasy male dignity to defend, who took them as he found them and was completely unselfconscious. Nobody could possibly guess from the words and deeds of Jesus that there was anything funny about women's nature." This is the kind of man this world needs. At the heart of the Christian message is the incarnation. It's the fact of God taking on our humanity. And he didn't stand on the sidelines as things got worse. He didn't watch. He acted. He stepped into our world. Jesus is not a part of the problem, but he's central to the solution. God knows firsthand what it's like to suffer abuse. We know this when we look at Jesus. He stepped right into the pain, into the misuse of power in order to save. Marty writes, as followers of Jesus, we recognize that evil is ultimately overcome by God and not by us. Jesus invites those of us who have misused power, who have objectified and exploited others, to come to the cross, to repent of our sin, to take up our cross and follow him. In return, he gives freedom, the freedom of grace, forgiveness, and mercy, with an invitation to use power for others rather than over others. This morning, we come to the Lord's table profoundly aware that our world and our experience of it fall short of God's purposes. God grieves over what's been broken. He laments over everything that has been lost. He weeps over the abuse that we experience or perpetrate. But God has acted decisively through Jesus to rescue, to reconcile, and restore. Isaiah writes, surely he took up our pains and bore our suffering. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. Instead of looking away, we are invited to look to our crucified Lord. And by faith, we cry out for healing, for justice, for forgiveness, for restoration. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after supper, he took a cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me, for whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. At this time, I want to invite those who are serving the bread and cup to come forward and to take your place. I'd also like to invite the worship team to come and join me on stage. We're going to have three different stations on the main floor, and we have one station on the upper floor. If I could just ask servers that you serve my right side first and then bring the elements over to my left side. I'm going to ask that people come forward to receive the bread and the cup, row by row, beginning at the back, working your way to the front. And as you come, come with your pain and your shame, and look upon our crucified Lord, asking for strength, for forgiveness, for healing and restoration. Paul, I invite you to lead us.